But on the way home from the three-star tour, Secretary Rumsfeld asked me to come home through Afghanistan and to take a team over there and assess how their train and equip mission was going. But to do that, I felt that I needed to describe the context up front. And so the very first slide in that particular briefing to him when I got back was titled "Afghanistan Does Not Equal Iraq." And it laid out all the ways in which Afghanistan was much tougher than Iraq.
Hello and welcome to the pod. Today I'm joined by General David Petraeus, former commander of US forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, and known for his successful surges, and Lord Andrew Roberts, historian and author of Napoleon the Great, Masters and Commanders, and George III. And we're talking post-war conflicts from Korea to Ukraine via Malaya, Vietnam, Iraq and Afghanistan. And we'll be looking at what the future holds. Together, they've written Conflict, the Evolution of Warfare from 1945 to Ukraine, and so they joined me recently for a chat. General Petraeus went on to become director of the CIA after his military career and served under Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. I should mention that we were speaking before the Hamas terrorist attacks of the 7th of October, and so I will be covering the history of Israel and Palestine as a bonus episode next week. Please do rate, review and share, as their insights are fascinating and applicable in Ukraine and indeed what's going on in Gaza, because Petraeus is a master of counterinsurgency. Until then, I'll hand you over to me talking with the General and Andrew Roberts. General Petraeus, Lord Roberts, thank you very much for joining me. Welcome. I wanted to start by asking, I watched a very interesting interview with the two of you at the Clifden Literary Festival in 2021. So that was within a few weeks, I think, of the withdrawal, the coalition withdrawal from Afghanistan, and a few months before Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And I wondered whether the book, and we're here to talk about Conflict, the book Conflict, I wondered whether that was where the idea was conceived. Lord Roberts, go for it.
No, the idea was conceived soon after the invasion of Ukraine. And the idea really was to try to put the Ukraine war in its historical context as a military operation. It's not a political book. It's very much a military book to look at how the Ukraine war was being fought with regard to earlier conflicts, and so how military history really has affected the conflict. So what we were trying to do was to do that, and at the same time we wanted to look forward. This isn't just a history book. This is also makes prognostications about future war and all the various aspects of future war that we write about, including space and cyber and sensors and AI, robotics, drones and so on.
Well, that was the section I found most sobering, actually. Particularly, I think there's a small section in that concluding chapter around potential for nuclear conflict. And that's interesting, particularly given the first chapter where you have General MacArthur and Korea requesting the use of tactical nuclear weapons. So I wondered, actually, this is as good a time as any to ask if a tactical nuclear weapon is the most likely weapon to be used. And I guess it depends on the theater, I suppose. But General, yes.
Well, I don't think it's the most likely weapon to be used. I think there are many, many other weapons that would be used short of nuclear weapons. Is it the most likely nuclear device to be used? Well, I guess. I don't even think that is likely, though. And I think we're seeing that play out, frankly, in the decision-making in Moscow on Ukraine. What we've seen is Putin and his various ministers have used the threat of nuclear weapons. They've done a bit of saber rattling about that. They've really tried everything they could do to intimidate the West, to dissuade the West from supporting Ukraine in the way that we actually have, to prevent each of these incremental decisions that have increased the capabilities that the US and the West have provided to Ukraine, all obviously unsuccessfully, because I think there's been sufficient dissuasion of Moscow from actually contemplating using these devices. And in this case, it's been very helpful, not just to have unity among, again, U.S. and other NATO leaders on this issue, but to have President Xi of China and Prime Minister Modi of India both publicly warn Putin not to use tactical nuclear weapons. And then I think just the sheer logic of this, that a tactical nuclear weapon has a tactical effect and would not really demonstrably change the battlefield situation. And if anything, whatever gains Russia might reap from this, noting that the wind tends to blow in their direction, not in Ukraine's direction, but whatever that might, quote, achieve, would very likely be offset in the global response to such crossing of a very significant threshold, where countries that have to date either stood on the sideline or only tepidly admonished Russia, in contrast, of course, to the Western response, which has been very clear about this brutal and unprovoked invasion. But I think use of nuclear weapons of any type, including tactical, would result in enormous approbation of Russia. And again, all countries, I think, would have to take a stand against that and to take actions, punitive actions in various ways, not just what, again, a U.S.-led coalition might actually do in Ukraine and on the Black Sea and so forth, but also in terms of financial, economic, personal, and diplomatic sanctions of even greater nature than those that have already been imposed on Russia.
I think also, you know, it's been established pretty well since the Korean War onwards that you can have full-scale wars which are fought under the auspices, essentially, of mutually assured destruction. I mean, that doesn't count the Chinese Civil War because that was fought before the Russians got the nuclear bomb, but many, many wars before. And what hasn't tended to happen is anybody making these kind of blackmail threats that you get from Sergei Lavrov and from Vladimir Putin. They've been regular, they've been obvious, they haven't sort of resorted to euphemism. They've basically tried to paint a situation in which they're forced to use nuclear weapons. And that's a new departure. Just the very saber-rattling language is something that shows quite how vicious the Russians are, even though, as David says, I think it's very unlikely they're actually going to use them.
Even desperate, actually, I think, would also be another word to describe what has led them to carry out this nuclear saber-rattling and also the movement of the weapons to Belarus. They intended that to be particularly threatening. But the truth is, it doesn't matter where a nuclear weapon comes from. If it's Russian, again, that literally is immaterial. But so far, certainly, while there should be concern about this, and there is concern about it, the actions taken to dissuade Putin clearly have been successful.
And also another point I think is worth making, and we certainly, when David and I visited Kyiv a few months ago, we heard this, that probably more likely than the use, deliberate use of tactical nuclear weapons would be the explosion of the Zaporizhia nuclear facility there. I mean, it's one of the biggest, if not the biggest, in Europe. It has been woefully badly treated by the Russians, who've shelled it on one occasion. The most, you know, irresponsible thing you can think of, shelling a nuclear power plant. And if there was to be a leakage there, I think that you would get a lot of Russian disinformation attempting to blame it on the Ukrainians. And it would be an extremely unpleasant thing for everybody involved, but it would be the Russians' fault ultimately.
As would the kind of false flag attack that Ukraine has warned Russia has been planning, where, you know, there would be seemingly some kind of event on Russian soil of a dirty bomb or what have you that would be, again, attributed to Ukraine and would justify Russia taking some particularly egregious action. Although, again, it's hard to imagine how much more egregious they could get, given the essentially destruction, the efforts to destroy the civilian infrastructure of Ukraine, not just the military infrastructure.
Well, General, we're speaking, and actually rather a sort of strange time in the Western commitment to Ukraine, because Speaker McCarthy has just been overthrown and US aid looks like it's been suspended. We're hoping it's only a suspension. And I wondered, did this therefore mean that Ukraine is now, the Western world that's been so strong up till now, is it now wavering?
Well, again, I think this generates legitimate concerns, but the reality is, as the Department of Defense announced in Washington today, they still have $5 to $6 billion of assistance to provide to Ukraine on top of the already $44 billion that has been provided from just the United States alone, with European countries providing a similar amount, perhaps even a little bit more in terms of pledges of security assistance. And then very, very substantial quantities of humanitarian, financial, and economic support as well. And you'll have seen the EU has just called for additional support. Other countries have all done that. President Biden has done so as well. And I think that once this is resolved in the House, and it may take some time to do it, it took a considerable number of votes for Speaker McCarthy finally to get elected, and he had to make enormous concessions to certain elements of his party, which of course ultimately brought about his downfall. But once that is sorted out, there is still very much, very, very strong bipartisan consensus in the Senate for support of Ukraine, and really in the House as well. There is a bipartisan majority that does support continuing Ukraine assistance. And I suspect that at some point, leaders in Congress will get together of both parties that want to continue the effort and put together a package that includes not just Ukrainian assistance, but also funding for border security, additional border security for the U.S. southern border in particular, and then probably appropriations for a variety of different disaster relief measures. Given the wildfires and terrible storms and other calamities that we've seen, for which there's inadequate funding. We're starting to run out of this funding for the agency that oversees these emergency management efforts. And again, if you can do that, I think you can cobble together sufficient support in Congress to continue the very, very important component that is the U.S. support to Ukraine.
Lord Roberts, I was wondering if you could put the Ukraine conflict in a historical context, because, I mean, I thought that the moment the invasion took place, this was after 9/11 and the financial crash of 2008, the third biggest event to hit, well, certainly the West post the fall of the wall. But I wondered if you could put it in context.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. Yes, it's a seminal moment in world history. It's enormously significant. The idea of a war, a major war breaking out in Europe, is a completely shocking thing, really. The way in which Russia, in a totally unprovoked way, this is one of the interesting things about it. You know, Putin had been planning for this. British and American intelligence services quite correctly stated that this was about to happen and were proved right in a great intelligence coup, frankly, for the CIA and MI6. And it was essentially ripping up the post-war settlement. It was a much bigger thing than other European fighting, such as the Balkans in the 1990s, because it's a state crossing the borders of another state in a full-on conflagration, and with large numbers of Russians being killed as well. So yes, I think I think this is much bigger than the one of the analogies you put, the financial crash of 2008. It's bigger than COVID. It's bigger than a large number of the wars that we've seen since 1945. And the implications of it are, as David was implying just now, absolutely massive. They stretch all the way to Taiwan. So it is tremendously important that the West continues its support for Ukraine for reasons that actually go far beyond the borders of Ukraine.
And if I could add even further historic context, just in terms of what we see on the battlefield, Ukraine is this very curious mix of World War I-like combat with massive trenches and minefields and concertina wire and obstacles and so forth. It has Cold War armored systems. These are the very same systems, by and large, maybe in some cases a bit modernized, but not in all, that when I was a major in a mechanized infantry brigade in Germany on the inter-German border, this is what we expected to face on the side of the Warsaw Pact, T-72 tanks and the like. And we were employing the systems that you're seeing employed on the Ukrainian side increasingly as well, Leopards and now the M1 Abrams tanks. But then you've got unmanned air and maritime and to some degree ground systems that are becoming increasingly important. This is increasingly a war of drones, some of which are remotely piloted and others of which are actually algorithmically piloted, if you will. It's the program. So the human in the loop is the individual that designs the program that actually guides the actions of the particular unmanned system. And it's all carried out for the first time ever, really, in a context that is uniquely transparent, because just about everybody on the battlefield has a smartphone, has access to the internet, and can upload videos, photographs, other data and so forth to websites and social media platforms, which give this a degree of open source intelligence that is completely unprecedented. The challenge, of course, is that there is so much out there that one needs the data aggregators, if you will, or the applications that enable you to fuse all of this intelligence. And then, of course, in the intelligence community, to take all that is available in open source and then merge it as well with the intelligence that is gathered through classified sources and methods. So it's really quite a hybrid war in that regard as well. One that has, again, elements of everything from All Quiet on the Western Front to Blade Runner, to use the description that Max Boot has so aptly provided.
Well, you mentioned drone attacks there, and you as a commander might find this rather an uncomfortable question, because with the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, the leader of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, taken out by the US in 2020, do you think that's going to be another form that we'll see more in the future, commanders actually targeted personalities by such drones?
Well, you see this on a near daily basis in Ukraine. Among the most important targets sought by either side are those that are the headquarters of everything from battalions to brigades and the echelons above that. Not to mention, in the case of Russia, going after the, you know, going downtown in Kyiv and trying to strike various leadership facilities there, although with much less success because of the very impressive development of the air and ballistic missile defenses around Kyiv. In fact, when Andrew and I were there about 4 months ago, when I was just there a few weeks ago, the sirens go off now in Kyiv and very few people actually go to the air raid shelters because of the confidence in these particular systems. But the effort is still ongoing. And it's well known as well that there were also human operatives that were swarming throughout Kyiv looking for President Zelensky and other major Ukrainian leaders as well.
I wanted to go back to the figure of Douglas MacArthur. He's a fascinating man. And I wondered if he is also a cautionary a lesson for commanders, US commanders. I can see, yes, Lord Roberts is chomping at the bit.
Yes, he very much is a cautionary lesson for commanders. The civil-military connection is and relationship is an absolutely central one in any democracy. And frankly, Douglas MacArthur overstepped it. He was keen to extend the war. He was he obviously got the big strategic idea incredibly wrong when he failed to recognize that the Chinese were crossing the Yellow River in vast numbers. And then he also wanted to push further up the 38th parallel once he had landed at Incheon and turned the war later on. So, and then he started talking about nuclear weapons as well, just to bring it back to your first question. And he didn't have the imprimatur of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and certainly not of the White House. So it is a pretty classic case here of going too far.
And again, it wasn't just that he was seen as being insubordinate to the real commander-in-chief, the president of the United States. It was that, as Andrew said, he failed to get the big ideas right. He didn't recognize that marching north to the Yalu would actually bring the Chinese into the war, which totally changed the context of that war and the dynamics on the ground, bringing vast forces of the Chinese into that to support their North Korean partners. And again, almost running the U.S.-led coalition forces off the peninsula. And this brings us to the element of this book that really jumped out for Andrew and for me over the course of our writing of it, that led us to go back and really rewrite the first chapter or so, where we talk about the criticality of sound strategic leadership. And this is leadership at the very, very top. It's both the political leadership and it is the military leadership in that particular theater of war. And that has to be proper. It has to perform four tasks, the first of which is to get the big ideas right, the overarching strategy. It has to communicate the big ideas through the breadth and depth of the organization and to all other stakeholders. Strategic leaders have to oversee the implementation of the big ideas, what we normally think of as leadership, example, energy, inspiration, getting great people, inspiring them, incentivizing them, allowing those not measuring up to move on, how you spend your time, the metrics that you use, et cetera. And then a fourth task, sometimes overlooked, which is formally to sit down and determine how you need to refine the big ideas so you can continue the process again and again and again. And in the book, we lay out a number of cases in which there is very impressive strategic leadership, in some cases in the capitals of the countries leading an effort. Let's say George H.W. Bush, who at the very first meeting of the U.S. National Security Council states, this will not stand, about the Saddam's army invasion of Kuwait. Well, the military now knows what the mission is. And then they exercise very impressive strategic leadership as well. General Powell in the Pentagon, General Schwarzkopf in the theater of war. But we also see cases in which that was not what happened. And of course, the MacArthur miscalculation was one of those. Both French and American leaders in Indochina and then Vietnam for the Americans didn't get the big ideas right. I mean, talk about a catastrophic big idea. Let's go out to Dien Bien Phu. We'll build a big base out there with French forces, and that will attract the North Vietnamese, and we'll slaughter them all as they try to take us on. And that obviously didn't work out quite the way it was intended. It led to a defeat and an ignominious departure from Indochina by the French. And then the Americans, who really didn't get the big ideas right until as late as 1968 with General Abrams taking command and finally getting them right. But by then, domestic public opinion in the United States almost preordained that we were going to have to draw down and hand off to the South Vietnamese forces. So again, this element of war is absolutely crucial. And as we looked at each of these different cases, the Falklands, where you have a combination of Maggie Thatcher and her military leaders, I mentioned the Gulf War, even in a much overlooked campaign, which both of us really enjoyed, which is that of Oman putting down the Dhofar Rebellion, where you have a recent Sandhurst graduate who comes home and overthrows his father, the Sultan of Oman, and then it is partnered with a superb British officer, General Sir John Akers, Brigadier at the time, I believe, who later writes this delightful book, We Want a War, which recounts how the combination of a great civilian leader and a great military leader put together a classic civil military counterinsurgency campaign that successfully dealt with that Dhofar rebellion.
Well, I was fascinated reading in the book that the Marines commander and I forget his name, I confess, who was reading counterinsurgency manual written in 1940, which was influential on the Marines in Vietnam.
Well, yes. Again, the Marines did get it right. They had, essentially, they lived with the people to secure them, which is the biggest of the big ideas about a civil military counterinsurgency campaign instead of the army forces in Vietnam, which were pursuing the large war, the big unit war, even though at least in the early years, you can certainly argue that at a certain point, North Vietnamese units required that kind of action as well, but not at the outset. And it was ironic that the Vietnamese, after the departure of the French, when the U.S. began to take over leadership of the coalition security assistance, wanted to develop forces that could conduct counterinsurgency operations, which would have been very much small military units, police, and civic elements. And instead, the U.S., with the lessons of Korea ringing in their ears, said, no, what you need is X number of divisions that look largely like ours, because that's how we re-established the 38th parallel in Korea. And that's what, indeed, they developed, even though those were not the units that you really needed to contend with the guerrillas and the insurgents that were the plague of Vietnam for many, many years, until indeed the North Vietnamese forces made more and more of an appearance.
And Lord Roberts, Malaya and Borneo are two counterinsurgencies that are hugely successful and so close to Vietnam, similar conditions. It's extraordinary, really, reading of their success.
Well, I mean, similar conditions in jungle, in that they're both, you know, fought in jungles, but they're very different political situations, of course. The very strange one about Borneo was that nobody knew it was going on. It was a secret war on both sides. The Indonesians didn't want the world to know because essentially they were losing and they had started the cross-border attacks. And the Commonwealth forces didn't want anyone to know either, because they were essentially attacking across the border into Indonesia, which without having declared war against them. So it was the kind of war that would be completely impossible in the era of iPhones and everything that we have, satellite technology and so on today. But in those days, it could be fought. And they very sensibly kept the press and the media away from what was going on in the front line. And the entire war was fought and won without anybody knowing. So that doesn't really tell us very much about the evolution of warfare from today, because it would be completely impossible to have happen. Malaya, on the other hand, is a different matter. When David was writing his famous counterinsurgency manual, he used Malaya several times as examples of the way to do it. Of course, it's important to remember that we had already offered Malaysia its independence. And so this was not a war of like the French in Indochina, hang on to a colony which wanted to secede. It was actually it wasn't a post-imperial war in that sense. It was an anti-communist war, a straightforward uprising against communists, and therefore should be seen much more as in the Dhofar Oman kind of scenario, I think.
But a masterful campaign. And, you know, a commander who also, by the way, had enormous civil authority by and large. So you had a degree of unity of command in that particular effort that's somewhat unique as well in these counterinsurgency campaigns. But a campaign in which the big ideas were just spot on. And I know that Andrew, who led on that chapter, enjoyed that particular aspect of this very much, not the least of which it was a success for the Brits.
Well, a chapter that you not only led, I think wrote, the chapter on Afghanistan, I was very interested in. And I wondered, because the Taliban and the Haqqani networks were able to find a safe haven in Pakistan, did that always make Afghanistan, you won't probably like me suggesting this, but make Afghanistan nigh on impossible to secure in a long-term basis?
Well, it made it exceedingly difficult, without question. Now, there were hopes at various times that our Pakistani partners, whom we were supporting in a variety of different ways, not the least of which is about $3 to $3.5 billion in combination of security and economic assistance, would do something about these safe havens in Balochistan, which is where the Afghan Taliban had their headquarters. We knew it well. We generally had quite good insights, if you will, into what it was they were doing and where they were doing it. Witness that some years later, Of course, there was one strike against the leader of the Taliban there. And then, of course, in North Waziristan, where you had the Haqqani Taliban or the Haqqani network closely allied that were largely operating in eastern Afghanistan. So again, that was a huge handicap. But I should note here that when I was completing my three-star tour in Iraq, keep in mind I was in Iraq for the two-star tour, the invasion, and then the first year in the war as the commander of the 101st Airborne Division, went back to establish the Multinational Security Transition Command Iraq, the train and equip mission, which grew so very substantially. And then, of course, as a four-star to command the surge in Iraq, and then actually to be the U.S. Central Command commander over top of the U.S. commander there as well. But on the way home from the three-star tour, Secretary Rumsfeld asked me to come home through Afghanistan and to take a team over there and assess how their train and equip mission was going. But to do that, I felt that I needed to describe the context up front. And so the very first slide in that particular briefing to him when I got back was titled "Afghanistan Does Not Equal Iraq." And it laid out all the ways in which Afghanistan was much tougher than Iraq, even though at that time the level of violence in Iraq was many times that in Afghanistan. The Taliban then, this is September 2005, were still reorganizing and putting their foot back in the water in Afghanistan and then going back out to Pakistan. But you could see that this was going to be an extraordinarily problematic, especially because Afghanistan had very, very little money compared to Iraq, which could generate $100 billion in oil revenues if the prices up and then you could get the pipelines patched up and the electricity flowing. It had no history of strong central government, had no infrastructure, it had no literacy. I mean, all the elements of Iraq that actually made Iraq ultimately doable during the surge, in particular when we drove violence down by nearly 90% and kept it down for 3.5 years, these were not present in Afghanistan. And I told Secretary Rumsfeld that even though the level of violence in Afghanistan at that time was much less than that in Iraq, that I feared that Afghanistan was going to be the longest of the long wars. And that did prove to be true. And that particular handicap, again, our inability, not allowed to go into Pakistan, except in very, very rare occasions, the raid that brought Osama bin Laden to justice, for example, that handicapped that campaign and meant that there was always a sanctuary in which the Taliban could seek refuge if we were pressing them particularly hard, as we did in, say, 2010, 2011, when I was privileged to command there. And for the one time, we finally got the inputs right. I should note here that we failed to get the inputs right in Afghanistan. By inputs, I mean the right big ideas, the military big ideas and civil military big ideas, the right level of resources, almost military, diplomatic, spies, development workers, rule of law personnel, and so forth, the right organizational architecture, that something is not trivial when you have a coalition and a U.S. Chain of command and various units of various authorities, the infrastructure, the preparation of our forces, the right leaders, all the rest of this. So again, it took us 9 years just to get the inputs right in Afghanistan, and that meant that we failed to take advantage of a number of years of very, very low levels of violence in Afghanistan, during which we might have built up Afghan security forces and Afghan institutions much more effectively than ultimately we did.
Just going back to the career, again, MacArthur, I can't get away from him, but his Operation Chromite, which it was this stunning amphibious landing, is interesting to read as an important lesson, I suppose, for Taiwan. I know that's alluded to in the book, the fact that amphibious landings, which are, of course, are surprise attacks often. And there's a great quote in the book from Paul Wolfowitz, who says that the surprise is that we're surprised by surprise attacks. So, you know, one can't help but think of Taiwan and China, amphibious landings and surprise attacks, and, you know, in the post sort of Ukraine world. Is that something we shouldn't be surprised about?
Well, you've just mentioned the Incheon attack and, of course, also D-Day are two examples of very successful amphibious attacks. But let's not forget Gallipoli, Anzio, Salerno, Dakar, you know, It's the most difficult kind of operation to carry out successfully. And so the Chinese have got, and of course the straits are much longer, they're 90 miles rather than the channel, which is 22 miles wide. They've got a lot of things to contend with. And when they look, as they do look constantly at Ukraine, they're also seeing a anti-tank weaponry, which is pretty devastating. In retrospect, it seems extraordinary that Taiwan hasn't got military conscription, full-scale military conscription. It's amazing that it doesn't. But nonetheless, it does have some pretty impressive kit. And also, of course, it's got the support of the United States.
It actually does have mandatory service, but it's fairly short, although they are now extending that service. But you know, Incheon was incredibly risky and incredibly audacious, therefore, which is one reason why it did actually achieve the success it did. It was very, very unlikely, certainly in the eyes of the North Koreans, that something like this could be achieved. If you look at contemporary scenarios, I think it's very hard to imagine how there could be surprise achieved in a world in which you can see everything. And that's one of the big advances, really. You know, we write about how back in the Cold War, there was this adage that we all repeated, what can be seen can be hit, what can be hit can be killed. But the truth was, we couldn't see all that much back in those days. Again, I was there. We tried to extend the battlefield in depth per air-land battle doctrine and so forth, but there were very limited capacities and capabilities to do that. And even if you could see something, if it was moving, our ability to hit, to do dynamic targeting was very, very limited. That is not the case now. Now you can see everything, you can hit everything just about. Certainly you can defend, you can disperse, you can take a lot of actions to mitigate the vulnerabilities. But at the end of the day, if it's above the surface of the water, there's going to be a degree of vulnerability with that. And so this is where the elements of deterrence come into play. And that's what we really have to focus on. We and all of our partners in the Indo-Pacific, look, you know, we want to see the most mutually beneficial relationship between the U.S., the West, and China. But we have to address the world the way it is, not the way we'd like it to be. And the reality is that there is severe competition, in the words of the U.S. National Security Advisor. And what we need to ensure is that that does not turn into actual conflict. And the way you prevent that is through deterrence, which rests on a potential adversary's assessment of your capabilities on the one hand and your willingness to employ those capabilities. Again, the perception of this. And we have to ensure we get a vote. We have agency here by ensuring that our forces can indeed present the capabilities that will deter a would-be aggressor. And in this case, we note that we have to transform our forces very dramatically and more rapidly than we are at present, from this very small number of very large, very capable systems, also incredibly expensive, highly manned, and to varying degrees of vulnerability, from that to a massive number of much smaller unmanned systems, some of which may still be remotely piloted, but many of which will be increasingly algorithmically piloted, where the human in the loop is the person who designs the program and the conditions that the machine must meet with its own systems and other systems of systems that are supporting it before it can take a particular kinetic or non-kinetic action. And again, we have to carry out this transformation to ensure that deterrence is very, very solid. And then we have to be sure that there's no questions about the willingness to employ this, which is why I'm sure that President Biden not once or twice or thrice or four times has stated that we would take action if Taiwan was threatened. But that means that there are implications of our support for Ukraine. It means that when there was a red line that turned out not to be a red line, that it had reverberations and repercussions. You can argue, I think, that the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan and the way the withdrawal was conducted might have convinced Putin that the U.S. would not respond as forcefully and as promptly and exercise the leadership that it has of NATO and the Western world in providing support to Ukraine. And again, we need to keep that in mind as individuals in Washington and other capitals are contemplating whether to continue to support Ukraine, which in our view is certainly very clear that it's an imperative. Again, not just because Ukraine deserves and merits that support and because they've been brutally and without provocation invaded, but also because that has repercussions elsewhere in the world and can undermine deterrence elsewhere in the world.
I know we're running out of time, but I just had one final question, really, which is this time next year, we're going to be in the middle of a US election. And I wondered how key for both of you, you feel the conflict in Ukraine will, how big a part it will play.
Well, look, I usually leave domestic politics to others, but since there's only a UK political figure here in the House of Lords, I guess I should just observe the truism in American politics is that elections, presidential elections, are normally about domestic issues, particularly domestic economic issues. And, you know, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Those kinds of questions. It's about your own wallet or pocketbook. And that those are the kinds of issues that typically are the determining factors. There will be undoubtedly discussion of America's role in the world. Some who believe that we should continue to keep all these plates spinning together with our partners and allies from around the world. And I would count myself among those. Others who will perhaps say that we should have a lesser role in the world, or perhaps should focus on the Indo-Pacific, from which this is a diversion, which I think is very, very arguable. I don't think that what we're providing to Ukraine keeps us from providing what's needed elsewhere. And that, again, the U.S. uniquely, together with its closest allies and partners, the U.K. being at the top of that list, has got to keep all these plates spinning around the world. In other words, keeping an eye not just on what's going on out in Europe, but also North Korea, again, the Indo-Pacific, various Islamist extremist groups that still exist around the world, where we're still keeping an eye and pressure on them, Iran and its various threats and so forth, cyber threats, all of these different issues that exist. The U.S. and its Western allies and partners have to keep these plates spinning. And if they don't, then there will be consequences, and those will not be desirable. But at the end of the day, I think, again, the key factors in the election will be those that revolve around, again, the economy. As President Clinton famously said, it's the economy, stupid. And there, that was a profoundly big idea.
I think we're very fortunate, of course, as well as the American election next year, next autumn, we're also going to be having a British election. Fortunately, the two contenders, Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, both see very much eye to eye on Ukraine, and there isn't a ideological divide. We don't have an isolationist wing, of course, in our politics, such as seems to be opening up in the Republican Party at the moment, tragically, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I should just note here that what Andrew has just said is hugely important, because the UK has, in many respects, walked point for NATO in the response to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. It was the first to have anti-tank guided missiles on the ground. It was the first prime minister, major country prime minister, to visit Kyiv. Most recently, it's been Storm Shadow. It was the earliest commitment of tanks. You can work your way through the various systems that have been provided. And the UK typically has been a little in advance of the United States. US and others have watched to see what the reaction is. And then, you know, then the industrial strength, American commitment and contribution comes. So I think we should recognize the important role that the UK has played in responding to this invasion of a sovereign country.
Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you, General Petraeus, Lord Roberts. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Oliver.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening. I do hope you enjoyed that. You've had two generals in two successive episodes. Please do rate, review, and subscribe if you can. Coming up, the film club continues with The Bounty, starring Anthony Hopkins and Mel Gibson. And as I mentioned at the start, I'm doing a bonus on the 20th century history of Israel and Palestine. So I hope you can join me. Until then, thank you and good night.